When I first learned the difference between streams and tables in Kafka, I learned it from Michael Knoll. Today I talked to him about that, but to get there, we take a journey through all of Kafka, from events, through topics, all the way up to KSQL DB. It's in today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Streaming Audio. I'm your host, Tim Berglund. And I'm joined in the virtual studio today by my colleague, Michael Knoll. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hello, everyone. Thanks, Tim, for having me.
You bet. Now, Michael, you are a member of the Office of the CTO, sometimes abbreviated OCTO. For the longest time, I thought that meant opposite of a CTO. And now I realized it's Office of the CTO. I was so surprised. Anyway, seriously, what? A lot of us are familiar with that title, but what do you do in the Office of the CTO?
Yeah, let me answer that question by going on a slight detour. So I joined Confluent very early on, one of the first few employees. And most of my years at Confluent were spent being the product manager for one of our product lines, which was stream processing in my case. So I've been working on Kafka streams and KSQL DB, etc. And I did that until last year when I moved to the office of the CTO at Confluent. And what I'm doing now is taking a step back from the more operational role on the product side. And I'm now focusing more on longer term product and technology strategy at Confluent, plus a few other things here and there, like doing a podcast or speaking at a conference and some other functions that I do for Confluent. But mostly it's about this forward-looking work in our technology space.
Got it. Another thing that you do is you occasionally write blog posts, and there will be linked in the show notes of this podcast a series of four blog posts that you recorded, or that you wrote, rather. You don't really record blog posts. You record podcasts. You write blog posts is usually how you say that. And they, what's remind us of the title of the series?
So the series is called, Streams and Tables in Apache Kafka and what every software engineer should know about them. Essentially, it's a whirlwind tour through the Kafka fundamentals, going from the processing layer to the storage layer, concepts and fundamentals on that front, etc. Essentially, everybody who is interested in Kafka should find something useful in that blog series.
Totally agree. And that is why I wanted to have you on the show, because it was such a good introduction. And what I love about it is your goal is to talk about streams and tables. And it's funny how much I personally associate you with that notion, because you were the person when I was new at Confluent who first explained that to me. And every time I'm explaining, Kafka streams or KSQL or something like that to someone, it's that thing, this concept seems to be one that's sort of sticky. It's hard to get into people's heads. Like, everybody gets what a stream is if they know how to think about Kafka, but when you introduce tables, it gets difficult. And so I remember my own difficulty getting those concepts to stick at first, and you're the one who made it clear to me. Thank you. And you set out to do that in this series of blog posts. And I'm like, well, Michael's the streams and tables guy, so that makes sense. But I just loved the way you did it. You started at the very beginning, and I just want to walk through that whole process. So For those of you who like to listen to people talk instead of read, this is your opportunity to have Michael Knoll explain streams and tables to you starting at the beginning. So let me ask you the first question. What is Kafka? And I know everybody who's listening probably knows, but sometimes it's helpful to get a guy like you to give an explanation anyway.
Yeah, so my answer to your question, Tim, is Kafka is an event streaming platform. And I think, before I continue with that, I think it is important that, we're in an industry where a lot of things are actually pretty complicated. And most of the people that are using Kafka in practice are not like we at Confluent who are developing Kafka and dealing with Kafka 100% every single day, but they have a lot of other things that they worry about. People want to deploy things, so nowadays they have to learn about Kubernetes. Previously they did it on-prem, now they're moving to the cloud. So like Kafka is only like one share of everybody's mindset every single day. So that's why I think it's very important to help people get up to speed, you know, with things like Kafka in like a podcast or a blog series. And I think it's always great when we see people in the community, whether it's for Kafka or other open source projects, you know, give back, maybe not necessarily by contributing a very complicated pull request, for example. Sometimes it's much more helpful to help others understand what you just learned yourself. So I'm using, so to speak, your podcast as a means to encourage people that might be listening in that, you know, you could be the next person helping out your colleagues or somebody on the internet and in the community to make more sense out of technology. So that's just something I want to bring up here before starting our, you know, deeper dive into Kafka, because I think everybody at some point is a learner. So need to keep that
absolutely
in mind.
And really good point that everybody has, you know, at Confluent, we think about Kafka, we think about Confluent Platform, we think about Confluent Cloud. It's like event streaming all day, every day, because that's the kind of technology company we are. You know, suppose you work for BMW, you have to know things about cars and all the related infrastructure, or, you know, you work for Walmart, you have to know about retail, and developers there need to be specialists in those domains. And a lot of their mind has to be focused on that, and not hopefully all of it is going to be focused on infrastructure. That's what infrastructure people do. So yeah, that's a good reminder.
So yeah.
So it's an event streaming platform.
Going back to your question, you said no, it's an event streaming platform. Yeah. So then typically people ask me, okay, like what is an event? Like, is that like Netflix or YouTube? Is that what the streaming is about? I said, no, it's not that. So let me try to tear this apart. Now, that's a bit more difficult in a podcast than if you have a whiteboard, but I'll try my best. So there's event streaming on platform. So what Kafka allows you to do is it allows you to publish and subscribe to events. It allows you to store these events for as long as you want. And it allows you to process and analyze these events. And that sounds already like a very compelling value offering. But then again, like what is an event? You know, you can publish it, you can subscribe to it, et cetera. But what is an event? And simply speaking, an event is just something that happened in the world. It could be anything depending on, you know, the company you work for. It could be something that, you know, a good was sold. It could be, you know, a financial payment that was being made from one person to another at a specific date and time, etc. So that is simply an event, what we're talking about here. And Kafka allows you then to work with these events in a variety of ways. So I hope that is a good introduction of what Kafka is in a nutshell, without going too much into the tech side of things.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's good. Especially if somebody brand new to the topic who's just moving past the stage of awareness that there is a thing called Kafka, that's all you want to say at this point. We want to build this a piece at a time. So we have these events, and how do we organize and store these events?
So what Kafka allows you to do is then, you know, to continuously capture these events and then do something to these events as they are occurring. And in Kafka, this is being done through streams of events. So a stream of events is simply the history of what is happening in the world. And you just capture those sequentially as into these aforementioned events. And the reason why I think a lot of people are nowadays so interested in Kafka is that, you know, a lot of things have changed in the past 10 years. So, you know, the advent of mobile is one. The move to the cloud is another. AI machine learning is another trend. So particularly with mobile, I think we've seen that, you know, also as consumers, like an average Joe consumer, you're expecting your bank or your, you know, retail store to give you as great of an experience that you might get from, you know, downloading something from Apple, from the App Store. And this is really up the ante on what a company has to do now in order to satisfy their customers. And a lot of that has to do with speed. You need to be timely. You need to respond to things as they occur in your business, whatever that business might be. And that is why so many companies have started to use Kafka to model their infrastructure and reshape it so they are fit for, you know, the 2020s, so to speak.
Yes, indeed. So, and there's a particular term that I'm looking for, the place events go to get stored. We call that a topic. So tell us about topics, storage format and topics, how topics scale. Just give us a brief tour of topics.
Mm-hmm. So if we're starting at these, you know, events that we then capture into a stream, then, you know, starting already to look a little bit under the hood, that needs to be stored somewhere, because in Kafka, which is different to traditional messaging systems that, you know, people might have used, like RabbitMQ, for example, Kafka stores this data permanently. And it does so by storing these event streams into topics. And the topic and the stream is, they're very much alike. The main difference is that a topic does not have a schema. So when an event is stored in Kafka, and specifically by a Kafka broker into a topic partition, then the event needs to be serialized into bytes, because everything that the Kafka cluster knows about your data is just raw bytes, has no friggin' idea what is in the data other than, you know, some random binary information. And then maybe your other question then is, well, once it is in a topic, how do you get it back again into readable format? And that is where then you apply a schema to your data in the topic. And this allows you then to get back, you know, like payments or, you know, user location updates, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you've got some domain objects that you're thinking about at the application level. You're not thinking about bytes at the application level, hopefully. There's some sort of domain object, and that those get serialized and deserialized by a layer, which we'll wave our hands about right now. We'll just consider that to be magical. But that happens to get the things into bytes in the cluster.
Exactly. And there's one important thing that I want to point out here is that sometimes people think, well, the broker doesn't really do all that much, right? Like, it doesn't know what's in the data. It's mostly like the producers and the consumers that do the real work. And that is true. And that is true by design and by intent. Because this approach of dump brokers, and I put dump, you know, in quotation marks, means the brokers can scale very, very well. It's because they don't have to deserialize and reserialize messages as they, you know, come and go. They're saving a lot of horsepower that they can use for other activities. So in other words, this design decision of Kafka, the Kafka brokers only knowing about bytes, is a key reason why Kafka scales so well.
Yeah, and I sometimes, by the way, I agree with the fundamental genius of that decision. And it takes a lot of discipline over time to keep brokers dumb, because as you're adding features to the platform, there's all these reasons why you could push smarts into the broker. And sometimes I'll get people saying things to me like, well, consumers have to poll and polling's bad. And if brokers could push, consumers wouldn't have to poll. Yeah, that's a lot of state that goes into the broker. All of a sudden, you know, you're going to pay for that in scale if you want brokers to be able to push. Or, you know, we'll get into stream processing in a minute. Why stream processing doesn't happen on the broker. You know, we still have to serialize that data and move it over a network at some point to do computation on it. Wouldn't it be better to avoid that network hop and put stream processing on the broker? Well, you know, you're going to get some pretty big Kafka clusters that way. So I think it has taken discipline for the core Kafka team to maintain that broker stupidity over time, but it's so important and a good thing that we can't emphasize enough. How about partitioning? Did we talk about partitioning, the way we break, the way we scale topics?
Yeah, partitions are for me always something I really like to talk about, because I think a lot of people don't yet fully understand how important the concept of partitioning is in Kafka, because it's something that, you know, is ubiquitous one way or another when you're working with Kafka. And just, you know, to whet your appetite a little bit, when data is read from or written to Kafka, when it's being processed, when you're joining data, you know, from two different streams, for example, or from a stream to a table, when data is being stored, when the stored data is being replicated for fault tolerance, and when we talk about ordering guarantees, all of this is based on partitions. So we're talking about fundamental aspects of the storage layer of Kafka, which is like the brokers that we just talked about, but also the processing layer, you know, things like ksqlDB, Kafka streams, and other tools in the open source world, you know, like Flink, Spark, et cetera, everything happens there fundamentally because of these partitions, and it works the way it does because the data is being partitioned. So that's why this is super important to understand what these partitions are and how you make the best use of them.
Excellent. And we'll come back to that as we get into stream processing a little bit down the line. So we've got events are stored in topics. They're stored just as bytes in topics. There's some serialization and deserialization that happens to get domain objects in and out. Topics are partitioned, which is our way of really scaling how big topics can be. And you stressed this, topics are durable. Kafka stores messages in a durable and potentially permanent way. It's not like an ephemeral queue where we're just trying to hold things for a little bit till we can get back to them. Tell me about consumers. I want to set up this idea of streams and tables and what happens. So just talk to me a little bit about, without any sort of stream processing API, what life is like reading from a topic, just being a Kafka consumer.
So when you're reading from Kafka, and what I'm trying now is I try to paint a picture in your mind, you know, for those of you who are listening in, because otherwise it might be a bit difficult to understand. Imagine you have a canvas in front of you, and you're dividing it in two halves, a left half and a right half. On the left half, you have a topic. And on the right half, you have your consumers. That could be, a Kafka Streams application, could be, KSQL DB. It could be a plain Kafka consumer that you're using in, your microservice, et cetera. Now, on the left side, where the topic is partitioned. Let's say it has four partitions, color-coded, maybe green, blue, red, and yellow. And now your application on the right side wants to read from that topic. Now, what is happening behind the scenes when you're creating your application that wants to consume, it will read from that topic through a consumer group. And inside that consumer group, one or more consumers will be active and actively reading from those topic partitions, those four that we have on the left side with the colors. Now, as you're adding more consumers, which could be, for example, if you have an application that is containerized, if you're starting with one container, there is just this one instance of your application running. If you're a second, a third, and a fourth container, now there are four of them simultaneously processing and consuming data inside the same consumer group. Then what we can do now is we can draw a line from the partition on the left side, let's say the green partition, we can draw a line to the right side to the green consumer inside that consumer group. And this is the way that Kafka allows you to read data in parallel and lets you scale the processing, which includes consumption, but also producing new events that you derive from your original data. And as machines come and go, or as containers come and go, these lines can, from left to right, these lines can move from one container to another container, as these containers are being added or removed from the picture. I hope that was a good semi-visual overview of what is going on when data is being consumed from Kafka.
Absolutely.
And the effect of that is data is being read in parallel. And even in the face of failure or in situations where you want to have elasticity, like adding or removing capacity, Kafka will make sure that things are staying busy all the time in a positive manner.
Yeah, trying to make sure all the consumers in the group are, the work is assigned to them as fairly as possible. As evenly as possible. And yeah, that is a good description. It is sort of a fundamentally visual thing, but you've got some number of, we'll call them containers or, application instances, all instances of the same consuming application doing the consuming work, some number of partitions, and those partitions get mapped to those consumers. Those assignments get made automatically by the cluster, right? They're the consumer group and the cluster cooperate to make that happen. It's not like a thing you have to worry about in application code.
Exactly. And I caught myself, Tim, trying to use some words that we haven't talked about yet.
So it's hard.
That's why I hesitated a little bit when I was, trying to paint this picture. I was like, I can't use this term yet because we haven't even touched it.
Right. Just the whole Kafka platform, I've found, it's kind of funny that you say that. There are always forward references. You're trying to build it a piece at a time. And I've got a talk, maybe you've seen me give it, but it's this same sort of sequence where I start with events and I end up with KSQL on the other end. You try to build it a piece at a time, and inevitably you have to say, I can't really explain this yet, but here's this thing and it'll make sense in a little bit. And that's, that's okay. Understanding always proceeds that way. We're willing to have some ill-defined concepts sort of hanging in our mind for a little bit and then flesh them out later.
Yeah. And to add to what you just said, Tim, and this is maybe for the listeners here, how the sausage is being made. my blog series and, you know, subsequently this podcast, this started by a very innocent email I got from someone in Tim's team. Said, hey, you wrote this article about, you know, streams and tables on your personal blog, you know, more than a year back. Can't you just write a short blog post also for the Confluent website? So it was like, you know, how long could it take? It takes you maybe like a day or two, and then we have it. And this turned then into this, you know, four-part series. And we spent quite a lot of time on that, you know, to get it right and get the flow that, you know, you're not using forward references, as you just said. So, yeah, the sorties is being made in a way that you not always want to see how it's being done.
Right. And there's so many beautiful diagrams in it. A lot of work went into this blog series. But this is the Confluent Office of the CTO. Can you write a short blog post? The answer, you know, on something. The answer is no, but they will write some very good blog posts. They just won't be short. And that's what this is all about. It's a great series of blog posts. And so I hope, as you listen to this, also refer back to those in the show notes. There'll be some pictures and things like that that'll help. Okay, so we have a consumer group now. The way I always think about this is, some things happen when you write consumers. There are things that you're going to do. It doesn't matter whether you're in finance or manufacturing or retail or defense or whatever, right? Whatever kind of business you're in, you have evented data. You've chosen to model your system around events, and so you're using Kafka, and you're going to write consumers. You're going to read data from topics. You're going to read events from topics. And there are just some patterns that present themselves. There are things you do in consumers for example, you might want to compute an average of something. And if you're going to compute an average, if you just think of that like you would in terms of a database, you're going to group by something. And once you take events and you group them by something, you don't really have a stream anymore. You have a table. So I guess for the first time, tell us, we've talked about what streams are. Tell us what tables are. And if you could spend a little while differentiating between the two.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So let's recap very briefly what a stream was. So for a stream, we said it records the history of what happened in the world as a sequence of events, and sequence in the sense of like an ordered list, an ordered sequence of events, and it, you know, can potentially be unbounded data. So it keeps just growing and growing and growing. Example could be, you know, a sales ledger, or maybe my favorite example, you record the moves in a chess match.
Yes.
And now a table represents not the history of the world, but the state of the world at a particular point in time. And typically that point of time is now. So in the chess example, the stream would be the chess notation. No. Pawn moves from e4 to e5, etc.
So even...
And the table represents the board and what you see at, you know, right now on the board, you know, with all the cheeses having moved, you know, a few times.
Right. Let me stop you on the chess notation, because if you don't mm-hmm. know chess, I don't know chess particularly well, but you can imagine, like, you've heard in a movie or something like that, where there are like the two super geniuses who are just saying kind of like weird words back and forth to each other, playing a chess game in their minds. You know, they'll just say like, you know, king to rook 7 or whatever. And like, I don't know what that means, but it's this, you could do it as dialogue. So just picture the movie scene where people are saying these words back to each other back and forth to each other as statements describing the unfolding of the chess match. So each one of those, and you don't need to know chess well, and you don't need to know what those weird words mean that happen in that sort of cliched movie scene. But those are events. Those are descriptions of mutations of the chess game moving forward kind of one discrete step at a time. So just picture those weird chess words, and do not worry if you don't know chess. Back to you.
And you're talking about that. And Tim, I can also offer you something contemporary.
Ooh, good.
We have now a global pandemic at the door.
We do at the time of this recording.
You can also imagine. Yeah, exactly. And you can also imagine that, you know, one stream of events could be, you know, reports from hospitals and doctors about people that have been infected by the, you know, COVID-19 virus. So it could be, you know, tests that have been done with a positive result, tests that have been done with a negative result. And all of that information are from, you know, across the globe, or, you know, your home country, is being collected, and then you can compute the current state of the pandemic. So how many people are currently infected? You can also rewind the table in time by going back to that recorded stream of information to say, how did the pandemic look like a day ago, a week ago? What was the difference between, let's say, the United States and China or South Korea? So you can slice and dice your data as needed, because the stream will not forget. All the information, you know, ordered based on the timeline is available in your event stream. And then you can compute your tables above that. And a table could be, you know, number of infections per country, for example, which would be one way to group the data, or the grouping would be by country. And then the aggregation would be the total number. And what you can then do with Kafka is not just what I just described, but you can also have this table being continuously updated 24/7 as soon as a new piece of information arrives in the underlying stream that populates the table.
So that table is always a snapshot of the state of the system right now. You gave the pandemic example, or even just the chessboard. I mean, everybody understands chess well enough to know that, like, look down on the top of the chessboard and the position of the pieces is the state of the game. So the table is that current snapshot, whereas the stream is this record of the events that have unfolded to produce that state. Talk to us about mutability. I'll just put this out. Events are immutable, right? You do a thing, you can't undo the thing. That's just fundamental. And hey, as I always say, sometimes sad, right? You wish you could unsay words, you can't unsay them. Events are immutable things, but talk to us about streams and tables in terms of mutability.
As you said, Tim, we could think about a stream as something that, you know, it's like a, you know, a financial ledger. So whatever you write into that stream, you won't touch it again. And it is immutable, which means you can't change it. So that is the stream side of things. So if you try to draw a comparison to, you know, the relational database world, we could say, you know, you can, it's like an append-only table. You can only insert, append new events, but you can't update or delete existing events. And a table is a bit different to that. A table allows you to mutate data. So you can do inserts, updates, deletes, and so on. And then in Kafka case, it's the key of an event, and I haven't talked about that yet, but it's a key. The key of an event determines which row is being affected by a statement. And what is a key? So in Kafka, an event, also called a message in the documentation, has a number of fields. And the two most prominent ones are, you know, the event key and the event value. Event key could be something like, you know, the username, and the value could be what the user just did. And that was recorded as the event. And there are a few other attributes for an event, including like a timestamp, like when did that event occur in the real world, for example. Other things like headers, but let's ignore that for the moment because it's not super relevant to understand how all of that, you know, ties together. So to recap, stream, think about this as something you write into, but you will never change it again. And a table is something that you can derive from a stream. And here, you know, things can change. So as, you know, infections in a pandemic go up and down, you see that the table is updating along the way, whereas the stream just keeps growing and growing with more information that is being fed into it.
Got it. How about data contracts? We talked before about how we have domain objects and Kafka doesn't care. Kafka's just bytes. How are data contracts maintained? I mean, that sets us up for a difficult problem because our view of these objects, of course, evolves. You know, the definition of a domain object evolves over time.
So Kafka allows you, which is also, you know, a fundamental concept, to decouple the parts of your architecture that produce events and those that consume them, which is great. Like for a larger organization in particular, you know, the team that is responsible for generating some data, maybe like a car and, you know, how the car is moving or, you know, how the engines are working, etc. That team can operate independently from the team that is using the data then to do other things with the information. And it could be, of course, you know, more than one team. Now, what Kafka has, you know, in its design is that the producer and the consumer have to agree on the schema and the format of the data, so to speak. Because as we talked about before, the broker has no idea what's in your data. It's just bytes. So the broker can't help you there. And in practice, what does that mean then for Eula? How can, you know, the team that, you know, the car team, so to speak, how can the car team help the, you know, predictive maintenance team so that, you know, both can understand each other?
Right. They both have to have a common
and
view.
And there are variety of ways. Well, by the way, you know, I'm a German native. I have no idea how a car works. I'm not into soccer, and I also don't like beer particularly much. So I'm not representative here, but I'm trying my best to use the car analogy still.
Totally.
So there are a couple of ways you can do that in a company. You know, sometimes is you know, I refer to this in my blog series. Sometimes it's you and your fellow colleagues sitting in the, you know, company canteen and, you know, scribbling on the back of a napkin what the data format should be like, and you just agree on it, like out of band, just a convention. You promise that, hey, this is how I write my data into Kafka, so you know how to use it. So that is one way to do it. It's more like a, you know, free-for-all, wild west approach. But there are more structured and more disciplined ways to do that. And typically what we see then, you know, as soon as, you know, Kafka is gaining adoption inside a company and people are really depending on the data, so it's not like a nice-to-have side project, but it's like a mission-critical use case for the company. Like we have a, you know, customer of ours is, you know, running a stock exchange, like a pan-European stock exchange on top of Kafka. If this doesn't really work, you're into trouble when you're responsible for running this infrastructure for your company. And what we see these people do is they are adopting, you know, data contracts that are more explicitly defined. And one way is, you know, by using your Confluent Schema Registry, Afro, protobuffers, etc., where you use programmatic ways to ensure that what is being produced into Kafka can also be consumed again from Kafka and people can make sense of it. And something that we've added recently, you know, on the Confluent side is a feature that allows you to do server-side validation. So the broker comes somehow into play here. I won't go into the details, but thus far, and tell me, Tim, whether I'm going on a tangent here or not, but thus far, even if you use Confluent Schema Registry, it is still like an agreement on both sides that, you know, you're following the convention of using Schema Registry and so on. And with this new feature that we added, you know, earlier this year, we allow the server side, which is the broker side, to reject a message when someone tries to produce to a topic if that message isn't formed, you know, well formed according to, you know, your defined schemas. Which is very nice because then you don't have to rely on, you know, some teams to, you know, do it for you, but you can really enforce that, which is great if you have, you know, security policies in place, you have, you know, regulations that you have to adhere to, etc. So in other words, to wrap this up, because there are quite a few things I touched here, typically Kafka is a schema on read setup. So you're getting bytes as a consumer, you determine how you want to read it. But ideally, you want to really know that you're reading it in the right way. And, you know, Schema Registry and so on helps you to have this communication with those that produce the data, how you should do that. And with the server side, you know, schema validation or schema enforcement, if you want to call it like that, you can really enforce that no one can write junk data to your Kafka cluster, even if people try to, you know, skip the convention, so to speak.
Right. Now, and that's helpful because that, you know, we were intentionally being a little cavalier before saying, oh, there's domain objects, they get serialized, it's fine. That is actually a thorny problem. I mean, that's the problem of schema evolution, which is hard everywhere. Schema registry makes it a lot more manageable. We're also talking about consumer groups and how you can have multiple instances of a consumer and how partitions of topics get assigned to them. And so work gets done fairly. When we move up a layer into Kafka streams, and I think I should ask you to define Kafka streams, that whole assignment of work gets more complex. I realize as I'm asking that question, tell us about Kafka streams first. You used to be PM for this. Not very many people in the world know it better than you. What is it?
Sure. Before I do that, let me just add one thing to what we just discussed, because maybe it is a bit easier for listeners to understand what I was trying to get at. I mean, we talked about, you know, schema on read. I didn't mention schema on write, but that is what you get with server-side enforcement. Just imagine the following. Imagine you have a team meeting in your company. It's an international company. You walk into the same meeting room, but no one agreed that English is the business language that everybody should speak in that meeting. Imagine everybody would speak with their native language And you can imagine pretty easily that no progress would be made in that meeting.
That works in Star Wars, though. And notice everybody speaks their native language in Star Wars and everybody else understands it. But in the real world, that would be terrible.
Yeah, my son still can't understand how Han Solo can understand Chewbacca.
Right, right.
But there you go.
Yep.
Yeah. So going back to Kafka Streams, your question there. So Kafka Streams allows you to build event streaming applications. And it allows you to do that by giving you a library for the JVM. So you can use it from Java, Scala, Clojure, etc. to build applications that read from Kafka, write to Kafka, communicate also with other applications, you know, without Kafka in between. And what Kafka Streams gives you is elasticity, fault tolerance, and so on, and, you know, quite a few batteries included. So you don't have to, you know, build a distributed application from scratch. And that is a great value proposition if you're working either with, you know, a little bit of data, so not a large volume, but still mission critical data, or very large data volumes, because it gets rid of most of the things that you would have to worry about that are very complicated to understand and deal with by giving you that information, that functionality built in. So you don't have to worry about that. Example could be, you know, a fraud detection application that reads data from an event stream with payments, does a join against a table of customer profiles, so you know context information about every transaction. Has this customer ever paid with their credit card from Argentina? No. Was always inside Europe? Probably this Argentinian transaction is fishy. So let's alert on that. So that would be an example of what you can build with Kafka Streams.
Awesome. And it's providing for you a lot of framework that you'd build yourself. If you don't use Kafka Streams, you just program the consumer API, you're eventually going to build kind of some, as I put it, a buggy partial implementation of Kafka Streams inside your own consumers. So it's all that framework. And of course, Kafka Streams is a part of Apache Kafka. This is not a Confluent thing. This is a part of the ASF project and available just as an API that you can use. So with that, recalling the question I asked a minute ago, how partitioning and consumer groups interact, how partitions are assigned to instances and consumer groups. Sometimes when people start to think deeply about streams and tables in the context of Kafka Streams, they'll think, wait a second, what if I have a table that's really big? You know, it's this state, and you tell them, yeah, it's kept in memory, and it's also on disk, and some people start to freak out. They say, wait a minute, what do you mean it's in memory? How can I scale that? So what if I have a really big stream that's got a lot of state, like a lot of unique keys in it, and I want to make that into a table, you know, like it's a 1 million by 1 million square chessboard or something. Maybe make it bigger than that. That's hard to fit into memory. So how do tables scale?
Yeah, that would be a pretty big chessboard.
It would be.
So what Kafka Streams allows you to do, and the same applies also to KSQL DB, which is built on top of Kafka Streams, is the following. So And let me take a step back real quick, Tim, because I think we need to cover like one or two additional things so people can better understand what we're talking about. If you want to work with a stream in Kafka and something goes wrong, well, that's no big deal. No, everything is recorded in order, so you can just rewind, you know, like an old cassette deck or your backup tape, and you can start again. That's no big deal. So dealing with situations where, you know, something crashes, or, you know, you made a mistake in application, there's some bug, etc. That's not a big deal. You can just rewind your topic, rewind your event stream, and can start again. What is a bit more difficult, but this is being handled for you by Kafka Streams and KSQL DB, so that's one of the cool things. But I'm explaining now what happens behind the scenes, and that is a bit difficult. When you're doing certain computations, you know, like aggregations, joins, these are computations where you need to remember what you have processed before in order, you know, to produce a new result. So if you're counting the number of infections of, you know, COVID-19 in the US, and you want to increase it by one because you just got a new update from a hospital, you need to remember what the previous total was, right? And then your question, Tim, was what if that previous total is actually not just a single number, but maybe like a huge amount of information that you need to keep track of? And what Kafka Streams and KSQLDB do here is the following. They use local, kind of like a local database. In Kafka Streams, it's called like local state stores to, you know, track this information and maintain these, you know, this state, these totals, et cetera, for you. And whenever there is a new event, you know, they will look up their local data, you know, increment it or do whatever they need to do to the data and, you know, process the next event. That is also something that happens when you work with a table, because a table is, you know, nothing but state in this context. So whenever you're doing aggregation from a stream into, like, you know, average values, et cetera, or you're joining a stream in a table or a table in a table, there is some state that is being maintained behind the scenes for you. And that state is, you know, stored locally, but it is more like, you know, a temporary local storage, as I just described. Now, and that is probably what you're getting at, Tim, is, you know, things can break. You know, my machine could die, Kubernetes could decide to just kill my pod and launch a pod elsewhere. So, you know, we can't really rely on local data to be persistent and durable.
Right.
And what Kafka Streams then does is it will use this concept of what a stream table duality is. We haven't really talked about yet, but it simply means that you can turn a stream into a table and a table into a stream, etc. It will do like a streaming backup, so to speak, of all the local data into Kafka. And if need be, it restores from Kafka again. And that is, depending on your data, like a fairly quick process. In other words, whenever you're doing aggregation, joins, and so on, so the more complicated operations like to implement in a distributed system, what Kafka Streams does is it uses Kafka as the source of truth for everything that it computes. So if data needs to be restored because a container died, which would be like the failure scenario, or because you just added containers and you need to migrate some of the processing from the existing containers to the newer ones, this migration operation will also happen through Kafka behind the scenes, where the state data is being moved from A to B. Because moving the computation is very simple, right? When you're starting your container, your computation logic is already inside the new container. But what the container misses is, well, the data that I have to work with that this other container already, you know, processed and maintained, you know, over the past few hours. I don't want to do this from scratch again. Just give me what you had. And this is something that Kafka Streams does behind the scenes for you by using Kafka as, so to speak, like a very fast backup and restore mechanism.
Right, which is huge, by the way, because otherwise maintaining that state yourself is a complex problem to solve. And that puts you in the position, you thought you were an application developer, now you're also a distributed state infrastructure developer, and that's not money well spent. So that's a huge...
Yeah, you don't want to do that unless you really, really have to.
Exactly.
I mean, I like these kind of things. I like to read up on the concepts, you know, reading papers on distributed systems. But if I have to do that as part of my day job, it's great to know about it, but you don't want to deal with it yourself, like the nitty-gritty details every single time you're building your application.
Right, unless it's literally what you do, unless you're that infrastructure developer, you shouldn't be touching
it. Exactly.
So,
and one thing I want to mention here, just real quick, sorry to interrupt, Tim, because a lot of people asked me that question after I gave them that brief pitch here. A lot of people think that the data that Kafka Streams, you know, manages for your state, for your tables, etc., behind the scenes, that needs to fit into, you know, RAM, like in memory. That isn't the case. As I said, the data that is being, you know, stored temporarily locally inside your container or your machine, etc., it doesn't need to fit into RAM. Like whatever local disk space is available, it will use that. So it can be, you know, gigabytes of data easily. And that has the other side effect that you can get away with using cheaper instances in the cloud, because typically, you know, more memory means you're paying like an extra on top of the normal cheaper instances. And you don't have to do that with Kafka Streams and KSQL.
Nice. And you said KSQL again. So coming up against time here, maybe in conclusion, top this cake off with KSQL. What is KSQLDB?
So we said at the beginning, Kafka is an event streaming platform, and KSQLDB is for us, and that's something that, you know, we're happy to, you know, to have introduced into this space. It's an event streaming database. And what do we mean by that? I think a particular reason why I personally really like KSQL is that it lowers the bar to using event streaming. And, you know, by extension, using Kafka because it's still, and we talked about things that Kafka Streams does for you, but still, you need to, understand how you write a Java application, you need to package it, put it into a container, run it, these things. With KSQL, it's just much easier to get up and running. You can use, SQL, like a SQL dialect that we have to, build your application in a few minutes. And that can be done by people that don't know how to write Java code, which is a great value proposition. And what we also added to KSQL is the difference between push and pull queries, as we call them. So a pull query is like your normal classic database query. Let's say you have a table of users and you want to say, please give me Tim and everything that this table knows about Tim. And you get a result. That is what you've been using, MySQL for, Oracle, whatever. But what KSQLDB also allows you to do is push queries. And push queries are more like these, continuously running streaming queries where you're getting an input event stream and you're doing something to your data, like, create an aggregation, which would result in a table that is continuously being updated, or you're taking the stream and you're filtering sensitive data from it to have like a lower volume stream coming out of it that is, sanitized, so to speak. And this is something that you can do both with KSQL. And that is pretty cool because in many use cases that we see in the wild, when people are starting to use Kafka, you need both of these functionalities. So it's very rare that you only do, let's say, the pull queries, these classic queries that, fetch like snapshot information, so to speak, from a table, or applications that only do the push queries. Oftentimes you want to have both. And originally we started to add such functionality to Kafka Streams under the name Interactive Queries, but with KSQL, it's just much easier to use because we wrapped all of that behind the scenes in a slightly different implementation.
And so that's events all the way up through SQL.
Yeah, absolutely. Including what might be cool for those of you who are listening in and just want to now play with it after this podcast. There's also an integration with Kafka Connect. What does that mean? So Kafka Connect, in case you have not heard about it, Kafka Connect allows you, to hook other systems into Kafka. So you to get data from, let's say, a database like, Postgres into Kafka in real time through event streams. And then once it is in Kafka, maybe get it out of Kafka again in real time to something like Elastic for dashboarding purposes. There's Confluent Hub. I think the URL is like hub.confluent.io, where you can, download these ready-to-use connectors and you can, have dozens, I think it's more than 100 by now, of ready-to-use connectors that you can then use in order to move the data in and out of your KSQL setup as you're playing with it even, like even when you're doing it for the first time on your local laptop.
My guest today has been Michael Knoll. Michael, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks everyone for listening in.
And there you have it. I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at @TLBerglund on Twitter. That's @TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in community Slack. There's a Slack sign-up link in the show notes if you want to register there. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.